and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the death of Ahmed Chalabi, the chief salesman of the Iraq War, who all along was an agent of the Iranian government, while enthusiastically embraced by the Bush administration and the neocons as Iraq's Nelson Mandela, even though he had been convicted of defrauding a Jordanian bank out of $300 million. A veteran CIA officer who knew Chalabi well, Robert Baer, joins us to discuss how Chalabi and the neocons sabotaged an early coup attempt by Iraqi generals against Saddam Hussein and his sons that Baer was involved in, which would have avoided the very war in Iraq that the neocons were determined to make happen. Then we'll look into the battle between Big Sugar and Big High Fructose Corn Syrup, which has now renamed itself Corn Sugar, leading to a showdown in federal court that began today. The president of the corporate watchdog Eat, Drink, Politics, Michelle Simon, a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics and author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back, joins us. We will discuss how refined sugar is replacing high fructose corn syrup as a ubiquitous food additive, even though both contribute to the epidemics of obesity and diabetes. Then finally, we will speak with Wallace Turberville, a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs before joining Better Markets, where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act. We will examine efforts by House Republicans to undermine Dodd-Frank and weaken the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau by slipping bank deregulation into the popular highway bill, as well as a host of other ideological riders that will be attached to the budget in appropriations, killing important new rules at the Labor Department, the SEC, and the FCC. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer. And Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi politician who got the United States, more than anybody, I think, as the architect of the Iraq War, died today at the age of 71 at his home in Baghdad. You were the chief CIA officer in the north of Iraq after the first Gulf War. And I take it you had dealings with Chalabi back then, because the CIA basically gave the Iraqi National Congress about $100 million. And it's my understanding that even back then, you and the CIA knew that Chalabi was actually working for the Iranians.
Well, I think, first of all, Ian, what you have to establish is that Chalabi was in exile. He left Iraq in 1958. He had no basis of support. And while I met him, he never provided a single piece of information which suggests he had any following in Iraq. None, even among the Shia. Also, it was a question of, we determined early on that, yes, he was working more closely with the Iranians, was more forthcoming with him than he was the United States. CIA never liked Chalabi. The State Department detested him. The entire, you know, Washington intelligence apparatus hated the guy, including, you know, line officers in the Pentagon. Not hated. It might be a likable guy. It's just that we all sort of recognized that he was a fraud.
So how did this fraud get so many political allies on Capitol Hill and friendly journalists on his side? After all, he's the guy that got the ball rolling that ended up with the disastrous Iraq War.
Oh, he roped in all the journalists in Washington. I mean, they just, at that point, they didn't really care to listen. I mean, I met a lot of journalists that were covering the run-up to the war and just telling them what a fraud he was. And even the neocons, I told them. And I even told them where the intelligence was. It was absolutely black and white that the guy's not to be trusted, but they chose not to look at the intelligence. The journalists, the Washington journalists, the guardians of conventional wisdom, and the politicians, of course, they had their own political narrative, and the neocons wanted a war. It was hysteria at that point. And especially after 9/11, when you had to do something about the Middle East, and here's Chalabi. He was the right man at the right time for them. And on top of that, the guy was brilliant. He was a great conversationalist, one of the most educated people I've ever met. Charming. I'd spent nights with him talking about history, you know, Thomas Aquinas, Islamic philosophy, and, you know, intellectually, we all recognized he could run circles around us, people who dealt with him. But at the same time, we knew from independent intelligence sources he just was not to be trusted. And, you know, the neocons just didn't care. They don't deal in fact. They deal in ideology, and they wanted a war. And if Chalabi was going to provide the false intelligence, he was their man.
Well, specifically, though, my understanding is that you had, when you were operating as the chief CIA officer in the north of Iraq after the first Gulf War in the Kurdish area, that you were approached by a group of Iraqi senior officers who had a plot to kill Saddam Hussein. And this, you know, quite reasonably might well have avoided the Iraq war. And what happened was that Chalabi essentially betrayed the plot because he and the neocons wanted a war. And this effort to get rid of Saddam earlier was sabotaged. Is that...
Well, yeah, he sabotaged it. I mean, what I was doing was dealing with Sunni officers who wanted to keep the regime in place, get rid of Saddam, and avoid a war. I mean, we all sort of agreed that Saddam had to go. He was losing his mind. His two kids, Uday and Qusay, were also just cretins. We had to get rid of them as well, but we didn't think the system should change. We should leave the sectarian... a balance, if you want to call it, or the Sunnis on top, really. And the way to do this was to do a traditional coup d'etat and getting rid of Saddam in the middle of it, which he completely opposed. He went to the Iranians and made up this story about an assassination plot. And it was just, he'd gotten wind of this and told them the whole story. Yeah. And it just, at that point, it sent the United States government into a spin, a downward spiral, and it just the whole thing failed at that point.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. And he's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassination. So... here you've got this guy who's working for the Iranians all along, gets the U.S. into this war, helps sell all of this bogus intelligence and through, I believe, a relative who essentially sold George Tenet on the this character called Curveball, sold all of this intelligence that Secretary of State Powell was extremely skeptical about, but George Tenet managed to, since he was the head of the CIA, convinced him and others, even though he'd been told by Tyler Drumheller that this Curveball guy was a fraud, they never left sold all this bogus intelligence. And we know what the history is. But my understanding is that when George W. Bush was finally told by the National Security Agency that Ahmad Chalabi had given the Iranians the information that the U.S. had broken the Iranian diplomatic code, that was a huge blow to the U.S., and Bush wanted a clean house. And even then, the neocons in the Pentagon slow-walked Bush's orders to clean house and get rid of Chalabi's people. So it's extraordinary that the neocons have hung on this long. They've never been held to account. And if Marco Rubio becomes president of the United States, they'll be back in force.
Yeah, well, they were all part of Romney's campaign as well, the same people. They got it utterly wrong. I mean, the neocons, I'm not sure whether they're Republicans or what they are, but they've attached themselves to the foreign policy establishment. And they've simply just swept under the rug what's happened in Iraq, or that they effectively created the Islamic State. I mean, you have to look at it. That was the outcome of this. We have the Islamic State, and that was thanks to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And the de-Ba'athification, which was led by Chalabi, completely alienated the Sunni community and made sure that it failed. And then he also was part of the Iranian plot, and it was an Iranian plot, to put in these sectarian leaders like Maliki and Abadi, his deputy, who were the Dawa party. So what he got us involved in was a sectarian war, which I think when we look back in history, this is going to be the beginning of the 30 years war in the Middle East. And you can lay this at the doorstep of Ahmad Chalabi.
But in analyzing the motives behind it, assuming that the neocons are just sort of naive zealots who got conned, and they certainly conned the Bush administration, or at least played on their weaknesses. Now, the only players in this that knew exactly what was going on, were they the Iranians all along? In other words, was Chalabi delusional? Was he for real? Or was he just a cynical guy working for the Iranians?
No, the Iranians looked at Chalabi as a useful tool. They never quite trusted him, but he was always going back to Tehran. Remember, he worked out of Tehran in the 90s. He wasn't allowed to come through Jordan because he was wanted for bank fraud there. The Turks didn't like him, so in order to get in and out of northern Iraq, he would go to Tehran and had an office in Tehran. I mean, that was just sort of, those are more facts that were swept under the carpet, that he was very close to the leadership and always was and didn't even hide it.
Well, specifically, though, he was charged with fraud in Jordan in 1992 and sentenced to 22 years in prison for embezzling almost $300 million from the Petra Bank. So that's not small change.
He was a bank robber, and he carried on the same corruption when he came back to Iraq. With oil deals, you know, sitting on the financial committee and parliament and the rest of it. Just is vast amounts of money that they all stole, and he was part of it. He got very, very rich thanks to the invasion.
So then does that explain what motivated him? I'm trying to understand how one human being could do so much damage and what motivated him.
I think that he thought once he got back, I think first of all it's revenge because the family had been thrown out of Iraq in 58, and the Sunnis sort of crushed the Chalabi clan, and they were on the edge. So I think he wanted to take revenge against the Sunni first and foremost, and then once he got back to Iraq, he simply thought he deserved to make money out of this, and that it was for the greater cause. I mean, he liked to take care of his personal needs. I mean, he liked to live well, and he had a huge entourage and people, and he took care of clans and the rest of it. He was a typical a Middle Eastern, you know, head of a community, and that just it comes along with a certain amount of corruption.
Well, but obviously, you were talking earlier, Robert Baer, about his charm and his conversational skills, etc. The fact that he cultivated these friendships with Dick Cheney, Doug Feith, William Loody, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz and company, the kind of the higher echelons of the neoconservatives who populated George W. Bush's regime and essentially sold or lied to the American people and lied them into getting into this war and took the press along with them. Is there any evidence, for example, that all these hundreds of millions that he embezzled out of the Jordanian bank, did he throw money around Washington or was just pure charm?
I don't know. I've never seen anything to suggest he was paying people off. I think it was pure charm. I mean, he also knew he was dealing with ideologues. He figured out what they believed in and he pandered to their prejudices. And remember, these guys are the same ones that deny the science of global warming. I mean, so, you know, it's something infinitely more complicated, like Iraq, it's easy to get around the facts. And none of these people wanted to look at it. And again, I say the intelligence was all there. People in the government knew who he was and what his allegiances were and the rest of it. But the neocons decided to ignore, and this is even the CIA, too, early on, so the Chalabi was unreliable.
I was going to say, I remember speaking to Tyler Drumhill, who was the CIA European chief, and he told me that before Tenet briefed Secretary of State Powell before he made his UN address that essentially sealed the deal and sold the war, Drumheller told Tenet that Curveball, who the Germans were running, was, and who I believe was a relative of Chalabi's, was a complete fraud, and they shouldn't believe a damn thing he said. And, of course, most of Powell's testimony was based on Curveball's nonsense. So what is the role of Tenet? I noticed that there's a
Tenet was taking orders. He just simply was told to make the case for war, and that went down the line. And so they took intelligence that nobody believed in who was dealing this. I mean, no one in the CIA had met Curveball, which in itself is very odd. I mean, you don't take information from someone you haven't met and then pass it on. The Germans were skeptical of it. So at that point, Tenet passed the orders to take any intelligence, no matter how bad it was, and package it. That was a political act. It wasn't based on any belief inside the CIA. I mean, everybody in the CIA knew what was happening. And, you know, there were a lot of emails saying, look, there's going to be a war anyhow, and the United States needs propaganda to justify it, so we'll provide the propaganda. And that's what happened. I mean, Blair did the same thing. MI6 did it. Everybody did it. Once they first made the decision to go to war, and then they went to the intelligence agencies and say, whatever you got, whether it's press releases or whatever. But nobody in rank and file believed this.
Well, then the question arises, who was using who here? Was Chalabi using the neocons and conning the Bush administration, or were the Bush administration so intent on war that they were just using Chalabi?
They were using each other.
Uh-huh.
It was that simple.
Right.
He did talk the United States into a war. And they wanted a war. They didn't care whether they had weapons of mass destruction or not. They just thought that they needed to upend the table in the Middle East to make things right. And if Chalabi was their vehicle and Iraq was the most likely place to do it, that's what they went for. But remember, this is the neocons are not fact-based. They don't deal in fact. They deal in belief.
Well, but that's the case with the Islamic State. That's the case.
Yeah, and it's their version. That's the American Taliban.
Right. Right. So how often in your understanding of recent U.S. history has the intelligence community simply been shut out and not listened to? I mean,
I've never seen it to this degree.
Uh-huh.
It's always been shut out to a certain extent. I mean, Iran-Contra, there was ample evidence that the Iranians directly were holding the hostages, but the Reagan administration pretended that it was an independent group. So it's not the first time.
But the neocons had some traction in Reagan's administration.
That's where they all started.
Yeah.
That's where they all started. And Pearl, among others, hated the CIA and said these guys are, you know, trying to cover up for Saddam, or they're incompetent, or one of the two, and I've got this great source, Ahmad Chalabi.
Right.
And they did this during the Cold War.
But Bush Sr., when he came in, he cleaned out the neocons, and lo and behold, his son brought them back.
Yeah, they're like cockroaches. They just keep coming back.
So do you think that on this day people are observing the death of this extraordinarily, treacherous character, I don't know how else to describe Ahmad Chalabi, is it because this thing is so embarrassing, just that everybody wants to forget about it and sweep it under the rug? Or, I mean, I'm amazed.
Look, we've had two failed wars, one in Afghanistan, one in Iraq. No one knows what to do about it, how to fix the Middle East. They just don't know. So, and it's people just want to forget. I mean, the problem is this whole idea of not dealing in fact is carrying on through this administration as well, because they're fighting a rear guard action against this neocon think, and they've found themselves in the same, Middle Eastern quagmires.
Well, but just in terms of history and learning from our mistakes, the old expression is that those who don't understand history are condemned to repeat it. at least the British are having an inquiry. It's somewhat overdue, and Tony Blair's obviously nervous about some of the findings. He tried to get out ahead of it. But we've had no, we've had an, what, 8 inquiries into Benghazi, where 4 people died, and no inquiries into Iraq, where 4,500 American soldiers died, 33,000 were wounded, and 100,000 were disabled, along with millions of Iraqis killed.
Well, that's Washington for you. The way Washington works. I mean, it doesn't surprise me, and it, you know, it's going to be a long time before we actually wake up and deal with what's happening on the ground in that part of the world, which is getting messier by the day.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, which is the basis of the film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the battle between Big Sugar and Big High Fructose Corn Syrup. But one thing that is certain, life is good and hell of a time. How come you're so wrong, my sweet neocon? Yeah.
Oh, to live on Sugar Mountain with the barkers and the colored balloons. You can't be 20 on Sugar Mountain, though you're thinking that you're leaving there too soon. You're leaving there too soon.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michelle Simon, a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics. She is the president of Eat Drink Politics, a corporate watchdog consulting firm, and is the author of Appetite for Profit: How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Simon.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And 2 big food giants, or at least trade groups, in the food industry about to duke it out in federal court, district court in Los Angeles, starting on Tuesday. The Corn Refiners Trade Group, which includes Cargill and Archer Daniel Midland, are being sued by the Sugar Group, who've said that by changing the name of high fructose corn syrup to corn sugar, the Corn Refiners Trade Group are infringing on the sugar copyright, I guess, and therefore committing fraud. I guess that's a paraphrasing their case. So what's your sense of these 2 groups that are hardly paragons of nutrition duking it out?
Right. Yeah, well, it sort of reads like an Onion headline, really. You have, you know, Big Sugar versus Big Corn, and, you know, both of these industries are contributing to the crisis, public health crisis we have in this country due to poor diet. And so, yeah, the corn refiners, you know, have been hit with a lot of negative publicity in recent years over concerns over high fructose corn syrup, and so are trying to rebrand themselves. And the sugar industry is crying foul, saying, well, you can't just magically call it corn sugar. You know, sugar is our bailiwick, and you're confusing consumers. And, I mean, it really is quite a joke. I mean, both of these industries deserve to be taken to court, but not against each other, but by the American public for really causing a lot of, you know, destruction of our health. So it is amusing to watch, but really a waste of the court's time.
Well, but specifically, has the high fructose corn syrup, the Corn Refiners Trade Group, which includes Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland, which are massive global companies. I think Cargill is the largest privately held company in the world, I think, or one of them. So they've got some clout. But my understanding is that they're starting to feel the pinch, that they're not selling as much high fructose corn syrup, which is you know, has always been preferred because it's cheap and it's been used in food and beverages like soda, bread and ketchup, etc. But now I understand it's being replaced by sugar. Is that what's got them motivated?
Well, sure. I mean, there's no doubt that the negative attention has taken a hit, you know, financially in the high fructose corn syrup industry. And so, you know, the data is bearing that out. But what it's resulting in the absurd situation in the marketplace where now companies are, you know, marketing their products as being high fructose corn syrup free, or we have, you know, this idea that regular sugar, just white processed sugar, is somehow good for you. You know, seeing products being labeled natural because they contain white sugar as opposed to high fructose corn syrup. I mean, it's really ridiculous. And so the point is that, you know, both are equally bad. Yes, there may be some evidence that high fructose corn syrup is slightly worse, but, you know, it's a battle of these two evil industries. And, you know, what you call it is really should be beside the point. And, you know, that's really the takeaway here for me, is that companies are just desperate for, you know, marketing position and positive spin, you know, never mind the fact that they're wreaking havoc with the nation's health.
Well, I've spoken a few times to Dr. Robert Lustig, who's one of the leading researchers into childhood obesity, and he's for the longest time has been crying foul, both with high fructose corn syrup and with sugar. But in particular, high fructose corn syrup apparently does terrible things to the liver, which results in obesity, and of course, especially his childhood obesity, which is really unfortunate that these young children are so chronically overweight in a country where I believe something like 60% of the population is overweight. I mean, he makes the case that sugar is a toxin, whether it's high fructose corn syrup or just simply processed cane sugar. What's happened to that concept? Why is it that you and other groups like yourselves and like Dr. Lustig can't break through? Is the fact that you're up against a multi-billion dollar industry?
Well, we are breaking through. I mean, there's more awareness all the time about sugar being a problem, whether it, you know, no matter what the source of it. And I think we're seeing that in some of, you know, the marketing changes where, you know, some of it's certainly greenwashing, but, you know, we are seeing some companies even reducing their sugar content. Certainly even, you know, the companies that are marketing sugary cereals to children are, you know, getting hit with negative press around that. And, you know, Coca-Cola is trying to find a way to maintain the sweetness but lower the calorie content from you know, sugar. So I think we are seeing some changes. And I will say, I think that the biggest target right now is on the soda industry, because they are the largest purveyor of sugar. I mean, you know, the problem isn't just sprinkling some sugar on your morning cereal. The problem is really the vehicles of sugar. And there's no question that sugary soft drinks are the biggest culprit in that regard. And there's all kinds of activism going on right now against the soda industry. And actually, soda sales are on the decline. So I think, you know, the activism is starting to take hold. Of course, it's going to take a long time. The biggest challenge is, as soda sales decline in this country, you know, industry does what it always does when that happens, is go abroad. And, of course, there's now a global problem with, you know, sales of sugary soft drinks increasing in the developing world and so forth. And so that really is where we need to also pay attention.
And again, I'm speaking with Michelle Simon, who's a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics. She is president of Eat Drink Politics, a corporate watchdog consulting firm, and is the author of Appetite for Profit: How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. Well, when you speak about going overseas, there's the good and the bad in that. I mean, they obviously, you know, when the tobacco industry was in trouble and people started to cut back on smoking because of health warnings, they moved to India, China, and Africa in a big way. And I take it the same thing is happening with the sugar-impregnated foods, particularly soft drinks. And, of course, Coca-Cola and Pepsi are huge international products. But in Mexico, didn't they ban sugar in soda?
Yeah, it's funny that you think that. No, they didn't ban it. They implemented a pretty significant tax on a bit different. But the point is that it is showing some positive impact. And, of course, the idea of taxes stemming from other industries like tobacco and alcohol, where heavy taxes can actually reduce consumption. Obviously, people are going to be sensitive to prices. And so that's the idea. And there's a lot of activity now in the U.S. to try to get soda taxes passed. And so far, City of Berkeley has been the only victory in that regard. I think the jury's still out on whether that's actually the most effective strategy. But, you know, Mexico at least did implement a significant tax. And when it is significant enough, then it can have a positive impact in the sense that people will reduce their consumption. Taxes are a tricky business in the U.S. They're the third rail of politics, and it's pretty complicated here. But, you know, I'm for any strategy that works.
Well, but we've had, though, for the longest time, a sin tax on tobacco and alcohol, and it's understood that the damage that it does both societally and to human health, it's very, very clear. So I guess then it remains to make the same case that a sin tax is required on sugar and high fructose corn syrup, because the damage that's doing is pretty manifest, isn't it, with something like 65% of the country obese?
Well, the problem isn't weight per se. It's actually poor health outcomes. So, you know, people who are suffering from chronic diseases, whether it's heart disease or, you know, diabetes, is certainly a huge problem. So I want to, you know, get the conversation away from weight, because I think that's actually kind of a distraction. And Dr. Lustig and others have shown that it's not weight so much per se that's the problem. It's certainly associated with poor health outcomes in the, you know, morbid obese population. But anyway, back to your question. So, yes, we certainly know that, you know, tobacco taxes have been extremely effective because they've been so high. Alcohol taxes have had mixed results depending on whether they keep up with inflation, which in most states they have not. So really there's a lot to be learned from both the tobacco and the alcohol experience when it comes to placing taxes on soda. And, you know, again, it's complicated. The politics are extremely challenging. And I want to also be looking at other strategies like curbing marketing practices, particularly marketing to children. What are some of the subsidies that could be curtailed, such as corn subsidies, consolidation of the industry? I mean, there's many other policy levers that we could be examining, and not just really what are in many ways punishing the consumer at the very end of the supply chain.
Well, when you say politics is an aspect to the trying to solve this problem, I was struck by how in the most recent Republican debate, many of the Republican candidates for president trashed Medicare and said that Social Security was going broke. And of course, they ritually go trash Obamacare. But there was one candidate on the stage who did actually say something sensible about health in America and Medicare costs and healthcare costs in general. That was Mike Huckabee, who talked about how we've got to start, you know, going after the diseases themselves, like heart disease and diabetes and other things. And there's a direct connection, I think, between sugar consumption, certainly, and diabetes. So did that give you any sense of promise? I know he's way in the back of the field, but I was just struck by the fact that at least one of those candidates was making sense.
Right. Well, actually, to his credit, Mike Huckabee, when he was governor of Arkansas, was a real leader on nutrition and public health issues. And so I'm not surprised to hear that, you know, he gets it. That was one area where he did get a lot of the messaging right, and a little too much on personal responsibility and not enough on corporate responsibility. But he did at least speak out, and, you know, given his state's particular, you know, challenges when it comes to poor diet. So, you know, it's hard to say if that gives me hope. I mean, we need the Democratic Party to do a better job. And, you know, we've had, of course, tremendous leadership from the First Lady and the current administration on issues related to school nutrition especially. I mean, that's been fantastic. But, you know, as we know, the Congress is quite broken. And unfortunately, we haven't had enough good policies to go forward to really help address issues like marketing to children, which is, you know, again, hugely problematic. You know, Coca-Cola televising ads on American Idol with children as young as two watching that program, you know, pretending that all the while that they're not marketing to children under age 12. That's what they say their policy is, but their behavior speaks otherwise. So, you know, I think there are a lot of, there's still a lot of work to be done, particularly on how children are targeted, and also there's more reports coming out all the time about how youth of color, particularly African American and Hispanic teenagers, are targeted with soda ads and other junk food advertising. So I really think, you know, we need to address the marketing issues especially, and, you know, not just taxes, although prices are certainly part of the picture.
So if Huckabee's at least one voice on the Republican side, who on the Democratic side is raising these issues, or are they afraid of being accused of being agents of the nanny state?
Yeah, no, I mean, well, you know, we've had some, certainly have in the past, had some champions in Congress. Unfortunately, some of them exited, you know, it often happens as the good guys leave the field. So, you know, Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa was actually a huge champion on the issue of marketing to children, even though he came from the corn state of Iowa. So on ag issues, maybe not so helpful, but on the marketing side, he was actually a real champion for children. And, you know, but he's gone. So, you know, current champions, there are a few in there, Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut, and, you know, a few others smattered about, but, you know, obviously it's not enough.
So then is it up to the people? I mean, it's not as if there's not a fairly active health and wellness industry out there, and a lot of people seem to be getting more and more health conscious. Although I must say, I don't know whether you've seen this new report that says there's a rising death toll amongst middle-aged white men in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's no question. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done. What to do about it? I mean, obviously, we can't wait for our members of Congress to take it up. We're absolutely there. But the good news is there really is a shift in consciousness happening among many consumers, and you're seeing it manifest in all sorts of ways, you know, whether it's simply changes in the marketplace where big retailers like Walmart and Kroger and Target have to now start selling more natural foods to keep up with the likes of Whole Foods and the independent natural food retailers. So I actually think I feel more hopeful now than ever in terms of what's happening in the marketplace. But I still have a concern that those shifts aren't reaching everyone in this country. And as is usually the case, so we still have an economic divide, which is, you know, those who have means and are educated to be able to seek out those better foods and have access to them and can afford them are making shifts. And that's great. And that's where, you know, change we can really help shift the nation. And we also need to make sure that those healthier foods are truly available and affordable to everyone. And that's really where it does take more policy change and more focus on those low-income areas to make sure from a food justice standpoint that the healthy food is made more available and is really a democratic right and not just one relegated to those who can shop at Whole Foods.
Well, the fact that Wall Street now is turning its back on Whole Foods, otherwise known as Whole Paycheck, presumably because they're starting to realize that Whole Foods have been gouging the public and they're run by a Ayn Randian libertarian who doesn't believe in giving his own employees health coverage. But yet, you know, you mentioned Kroger, Ralph's, their organic food sections are getting bigger and bigger. So there's something encouraging there, right? That, in other words, Whole Foods have set this high bar that, yeah, we'll give you a good, healthy food, but it's going to cost you twice as much, which means that they're making an outrageous profit. So it sounds like the prices are going to come down so that there won't be this impediment for having healthier food because of cost.
Right. And, you know, you paint a pretty grim picture of Whole Foods, and I think that's accurate for a lot of, you know, for a lot of what the company's doing. However, also Whole Foods is recognizing that they can't just keep up that business model and you know, look like a company that's actually caring about what the American public needs. So to its credit, it's actually creating a new kind of offshoot, which is meant to be a more affordable, smaller store, and they're placing them in low-income areas. And I've heard really good things behind the scenes about that effort, that the CEO, Walter Robb, is very serious about that. And so let's see. see, you know, how that goes, and if it's well received. But that's not the only solution. That's just one part of the puzzle. And, you know, there are efforts going on. I mean, there's a store being built in West Oakland, not far from me, called People's Community Market. And that is an effort being brought forth by, you know, in a grassroots way, with what's called direct public offering. I'm, you know, an investor with a mere $1,000, and other people have, you know, stepped in to say West Oakland needs a full-service supermarket, and it's taking now a couple of years for that to get off the ground, but it's happening. And so this is just one example of the kind of effort that's going on all over the country to try and fix this problem of food deserts, to make sure that people who really need access to truly healthy food can have it more readily available. And other projects are going on. I'm involved with, you know, trying to get corner liquor stores to simply sell more fruits and vegetables. So, you know, I don't think it's all gloom and doom out there, but it's still extremely challenging, and we need more people, more effort, and more companies, frankly, to step up and see what they can do to help be part of the solution.
Well, Michelle Simon, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michelle Simon, who's a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics. She is president of Eat Drink Politics, a corporate watchdog consulting firm, and is the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into House Republican efforts to slip bank deregulations into the popular highway bill.
Wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wallace Turberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos, who was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute. Then he joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodities Future Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, and the House Financial Services Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wallace Turberville.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's great to be back with you as we discover that the insanity is not over after all.
Well, the insanity is not over, but the mendacity is being amped up. They're doubling down. They're doubling down.
Yes.
I mean, it's extraordinary to think that people are celebrating the fact that this new sheriff in town in the House, Paul Ryan, has made a deal not to shut down the government and blow the debt ceiling and cause the enormous grief to the U.S. economy. But the battle's just begun. I mean, they passed a clean budget, but just the framework, so that they wouldn't embarrass themselves, the Republicans, in the election year and do these crazy things like shutting down the government and refusing to raise the debt ceiling. But now we learn that House Republicans are slipping in, they're trying to slip bank deregulation into the highway bill, and then that's just the opening salvo in all of these appropriations committees that they're going to throw all these ideological riders in, you know, not just Planned Parenthood, but a whole, in almost all the important issues that we consider as progress made by the Congress. I find it breathtaking.
It is quite breathtaking, and of course, The first shot is over the highway bill, which has tremendous backing from all kinds of folks, you know, construction contractors, state and local governments, everyone who needs to have there are the construction projects that are going on highways and bridges and in for transit systems to continue in a predictable way. You just can't start and stop funding these projects willy-nilly. So they've picked a particularly good one to start with, and so to make it clear where the battle lines will be drawn.
Well, specifically in this highway bill that is being loaded up with gifts to Wall Street, they're trying to weaken the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and undermine Dodd-Frank and remove these restrictions imposed on banks with at least $50 billion in assets. So it's pretty clear where they're getting their marching orders from. What can be done to stop them?
Well, at this point, what they have the power to actually pass this legislation in the form that they wish. So the question will be whether the White House will persist and stick by their guns and take the heat from various sections of the economy to stick by what's right and make sure that they don't just give in on these matters. Some of these are very important matters. Just take the bank one for example. What they're saying is they're going to exempt from regulation 25 large regional banks. Now these banks hold about $4 trillion in assets, which is about a quarter of all banking assets that exist in the economy. And they're the same size that institutions like Countrywide, Washington Mutual, Wachovia, IndyMac. Those are the banks that failed in 2008, which really started the whole domino effect. So these are not like tiny banks. These are actually big important banks in the economy. And it doesn't make sense to turn away from regulating those institutions. So these are big power politic plays that are being made at the behest of some very significant business interests.
Well, of course, there are some Democrats on the Banking Financial Services Committee that are going along with it too. Representative Patrick Murphy of Florida, Terry Sewell of Alabama, David Scott of Georgia, Kirsten Sinema of Arizona, Cedric Richmond of Louisiana, Philemon Vailer of Texas, Alcee Hastings, of course, he's as crooked as a dog's hind leg, Gwen Graham, Noah Father, I'm disappointed in her, Grace Meng, Joyce Beatty, Emmanuel Cleaver, Frederica Wilson, Scott Peters of California, Lois Frankel, Mark Vesey, Brian Higgins, Sheila Jackson Lee, Brad Ashford, and Brad Sherman of California here, and Gene Green of Texas. So that's not really encouraging, is it?
No, that's unbelievably disappointing. It suggests that it's a free vote for those folks that because it doesn't really matter. The legislation passed, but it's also pretty clear. It's also quite clear that as long as the administration sticks to its guns, a veto could be is not going to be overridden because of the Senate. So there's a way out of this thing, but it's going to take something a little short of weathering a total shutdown of the government, but still a very dramatic set of events to get it done. And I guess what they sort of recognized is that shutting down the government and not allowing social security checks to go out, that is unacceptable, but a series of lesser forms of the same thing might trick the public into not examining really what they're doing so carefully.
And again, I'm speaking with Wallace Turberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos. He was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute. Then he joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs and the House Financial Services Committee. But what is particularly troubling about this highway bill, apart from the fact, as you pointed out, Wally, that it's, you know, kind of, it's not a must-pass bill so much as it's extremely popular with the Congress, because they get to spend money in their districts and fill potholes, etc. So that's obviously why they've attached this bank-friendly rider. But this is just the opening shot. You know, after this clean budget was passed with a framework, now all these appropriations committees are going to start wading in with these ideological riders, Planned Parenthood being just one of them. But many of them are so pernicious, it's just shocking. One is, for example, the Labor Department. They're going to forbid the Labor Department from implementing rules to protect seniors from investment fraud with all kinds of stuff that goes on the internet. Then another one is overturning or suspending the rules that the FCC have just developed for net neutrality, which was a huge battle that people think they've won. But they can overturn that at the dark of night in the back room. The SEC has finally implemented a plan to force American corporations to reveal their political spending. That's going to be killed as well. So these aren't small potatoes.
There are also items that, in one sense, are you know, seem like they're smaller, but in terms of what how it affects, especially the less people with less income is are really pernicious. For instance, one of the things that's in this bill is that it outsources debt collection by the IRS to private debt collectors. And besides being a waste of money, I mean, the IRS has got plenty of power to collect debts that are owed. By everything from, you know, garnishing income to everything else. By putting this out to debt collectors, you're going to have some very harsh treatment of some folks, especially those in the lower income levels that is really going to make life miserable for a lot of people. So there, you know, there's just all kinds of things that sort of a strange and evil wish list that seems to be bubbling up from you know, the right wing circles.
Well, the idea that private debt collectors, that's the same idea of having for-profit colleges or a payday lending. This is bottom feeding crony capitalism. I mean, these are the guys, the Tea Party, the guys that keeps talking about crony capitalism and how they're opposed to it. But they fund bottom-feeding crony capitalists like these debt collectors who won't bring anything to the table, but they'll just take a lot of federal money and make profits out of it and make life miserable for a bunch of low-income people who they'll be harassing.
Does anybody really think that there's a problem with the effectiveness of the IRS in collecting back taxes from people? I think that the IRS has extraordinary tools that they can use, much more effective than a credit card company or somebody else that might outsource to debt collectors. So I don't understand what the policy provision is that's being pursued here. Other than just the generalized aversion to taxes and the IRS generally, so it just doesn't make sense. And then there's a very tricky provision in here that addresses the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has done a magnificent job. They've gotten over $11 billion. In relief for consumers. 25 million consumers have been benefited by Elizabeth Warren's brainchild, the CFPB, since it's been in operation after passage of the Dodd-Frank Act. But they're this pernicious thing that they're going to do is they're going to switch it over from a director-managed agency to a commission-managed agency, and that just will bring all kinds of politics into it, because in our government, commissions are always designed with a one-vote margin favoring whoever is in the White House. And then otherwise, it's a balanced Democrat-Republican vote. So it's simply going to introduce a lot of politics into this and really make it more difficult for the CFPB to actually do their business.
Well, it seems that if Paul Ryan gets away with this, I mean, it certainly makes a mockery of the idea. People thought this guy was a moderate. They don't. They must have forgotten his devotion to Ayn Rand. I mean, it's pretty clear that there's not. You know, they may have avoided government shutdown and not raising the debt ceiling, both of which would have been a self-inflicted wound on the Republicans in an election year, so hardly doing anybody but themselves a favor. But the rest of this stuff is just an absolute nightmare. And at the end of the day, is it just going to be vetoed? I mean, what else can be done here short of a presidential veto?
Well, that's it. That's going to be it. It's going to proceed right down that path, and it's going to go it's going to go the path of the veto, which means it's going to be, you know, high drama, and I suppose there's going to have to be some kind of principle laid out that the White House is just not going to tolerate this kind of behavior, and there's going to be a lot of people injured. I mean, the fact is, when we say that this is going to disrupt all this funding for transportation, what that means is workers are not going to get their paychecks. The public's not going to be served. Transit systems are liable to run into problems, which affects cumulatively this huge number of people. Maybe the public won't see it. I hope that people are actually made aware of exactly what the level of distress that's really going to be inflicted by this thing. But I frankly don't understand why everybody has always been so quick to believe that Paul Ryan is some kind of a genuine sort of trustworthy character. I mean, he seems to give that appearance. But it's not surprising to me that this is his first act. Of course, his actual first act was taking down the portrait of the prior Speaker of the House that's been convicted. But this is sort of his second act is to put this thing out there.
Well, Wallace Tuberville, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Wallace Tuberville, who's a senior fellow at Demos. He was an investment banker at Goldman Sachs and Company for 12 years, then a visiting scholar at the Roosevelt Institute. Then he joined Better Markets, Inc., where he proposed rules and authored studies to implement the Dodd-Frank Act at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, Financial Stability Oversight Council, and the Federal Prudential Banking Regulators. He has testified on financial reform issues before the permanent subcommittees on investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, and the House Financial Services Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.